it might sound a little more true to you. The simple answer is this. Total agnosticism, ornery agnosticism, I can't know anything about reality, is self-defeating. It is saying, in essence, I know that you can't know. Well, if you know that you can't know, you know. And if you know, you can't say you don't know. Let me put it this way. Suppose, as Aristotle used to say to the skeptics, do you know anything? They say, no, we don't know anything. He'd say, do you exist? Now they're in the horns of a dilemma. Either they say nothing, mutus, or they say something. If they say something, they either say, I do exist, or I don't exist. If they say, I do exist, they know that for sure. They're no longer total agnostic. If they say, I don't exist, they have to exist, or they couldn't say it, in which case it's self-defeating. So they got real smart, and they'd say nothing. Mutist. Aristotle was no dumbbell either, and he'd respond this way. Do you exist? No answer. He'd go on and talk to somebody else. Why talk to somebody who doesn't exist? Now, I think we can press it one step further. And the step is this. Even the guy who doesn't say anything is thinking. And you can't think without existing in order to think. And you can't think that you don't know anything about reality. You don't have to say anything. You can't even think that you don't know anything about reality without knowing something. There is no way to say, I can't know anything about reality without knowing something. Now, modification. We're not saying that it is contradictory or self-defeating to say, I don't know something about reality, or there are some things about reality I don't know. I think that position is perfectly feasible, and I would think that every Christian would hold that. Now we see through a glass darkly. I don't know everything about God. I met a man who did once. He impressed me greatly. We were having a little dialogue, and I said to him, do you believe the Bible is infallible? He said, yes. I said, do you have an infallible interpretation of it? He said, yes. I said, I'm in trouble. I'm talking to the Protestant Pope. I believe the Bible is infallible, but my interpretation isn't. So I'll try one more question on him. Do you believe God is infinite? Yes. Do you have an infinite understanding of God? Sure enough, he did. I said, I'm not talking to the Protestant Pope. I'm talking to God. So I gave up. Now, once in a while, you'll meet people who know everything about everything. That, too, I think, if not self-defeating, is at least repugnant. And assuming that we don't know everything about everything, and assuming that it's self-defeating to say you can't know anything about it, then somewhere in between we know something about something is a position that has both humility and, I think, cognitivity in the sense that it's meaningful. Now, Kant's position was self-defeating, though, because he said you can't know anything about ultimate reality. You would have to know something in order to make that statement. If I draw a line here and say, I can't possibly see the other side of the line, then I wouldn't know the line was there. You got to be able to see the other side a little bit in order to know where to draw the line. Now, if you drew the line between appearance and reality and you knew the difference, how could you tell the difference between appearance and reality if you couldn't see over a little bit and see, oh, yeah, that's a little different than this? But if you can see over a little bit, then you know something about reality. So it is self-defeating to draw such a rigid line. Now that leads us to another criticism of Kant, and that is his separation of fact and value. Can you say, here is the realm of fact, the realm of appearance, and value is out there in the realm of reality, but I can't know value at all, I can only know what appears to me. The separation of fact and value. I think it reduces to a statement like this. I am a fact that has no value whatsoever. I am a fact that has no value whatsoever. But if I am a fact that has no value whatsoever, do I not value the right to make that affirmation? And if I do, then am I not a valuable fact? Maybe I can put it in a slightly different context and then bring it over. Once in a while, you meet somebody who denies all value. There are no moral principles. We have a student from Trinity teaching down at Purdue now, and he taught a class on ethics in which he had a brilliant unbeliever who believed there was no value in the universe whatsoever, no moral principles at all. In fact, this non-Christianist class wrote a brilliant paper defending the total relativity of all ethics, that there are no ethical principles whatsoever. He handed the paper in a blue folder, and the teacher looked at it and he said, F, I don't like blue folders, and sent it back to the student. The student, hear the rest of it, the student came storming into his room and said, "That's not fair, that's not just, that's not right. You should have graded me on the basis of..." He said, "Oh, I didn't know you believed in fairness, justice, and rightness. Had I known you believed in moral principles, I would have graded you on the basis of moral principles. But since you said you didn't believe in any, I thought you didn't mind if I didn't believe in any and just gave you an F because I don't like blue." Now, the point is that values are undeniable. And the fact of humanness, any human who would say, "It is a fact that I don't have any value," seems to me, when you unpack that, is engaging in a self-defeating statement. It's like saying, "I cannot utter a word in English." Just did. And to say that I am a fact without value assumes and affirms the value of the affirmer who is making that fact. I once talked to a lady who said, "Well, I don't think that man is free or has any value whatsoever." I said, "Do you value your right to say that?" Because if she didn't, I could have said to her, "Shut up, you old witch. You don't have any right saying that." Now, if I had said that to her, she would have realized that I was attacking her value and her right to say that. So the very fact that she affirmed it proved that what she was affirming was not true. Now, let me make one more comment on Kant, and that is that the laws of causality and non-contradiction do apply to reality. That the categories of our mind, causality and non-contradiction, do apply to reality, for every attempt to say they don't applies them to reality. I run into people once in a while, usually a mystic. Pantheism has invaded the West now, and you'll run into people who say, "Well, logic doesn't apply to the infinite." Well, just take that statement. Logic does not apply to the infinite. Is that a logical statement about the infinite? If it's illogical, it doesn't make any sense. If it's logical, it defeats itself. For it's a logical statement about the infinite, saying that you can't make logical statements about the infinite. And the same thing applies to the law of causality. Now, how do we answer Kant's contradiction? He said if you apply causality to reality, you end up with a first cause and no first cause, which is a contradiction. First of all, why should it bother him that it's a contradiction if contradictions don't apply to reality? Secondly, it is really not a contradiction. Not if you understand the principle of causality, which was correctly articulated last night. The principle of causality is not everything has a cause. It's every effect has a cause. And when you get back to something that is not an effect, you can't ask, what is its cause? It's the first cause. And when you ask, what is the cause of the first cause? You're asking a meaningless question. Because there is no cause of the first cause. It was first. And what's the cause of the first? There is no cause of the first, since it was first. It's like people saying, what made Lucifer sin? What made Lucifer sin? He sinned. His freedom was the first cause of his sin. And you don't ask, what caused him to sin, if his free will was the cause of his sin? Likewise, to say, what caused God is meaningless. God is the cause. And if he's the uncaused cause of everything else that exists, the uncaused cause doesn't have a cause. Only caused causes have causes. Uncaused causes don't. So if you state every effect has a cause, that's not a contradiction. You end at a first cause, but you can't ask the question, what caused the first cause? So his so-called antinomies do not work. One of the two premises is wrong in each case. Now let's turn to Kierkegaard. First, truth is not subjectivity. If truth were subjectivity, then sincerity would be a test of truth. A sincere pagan at his idol could be sincerely wrong. There's a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Or you could be sincerely thinking you're going south and going north. You could get up at night to give food to your, to give medicine to your baby and sincerely think you're giving aspirin and give poison, and the baby sincerely die. Sincerity is not a test for truth. Simply because somebody is subjectively and passionately encountering something doesn't mean that it's true. He might be shacking up with a harlot. That's subjective, passionate encounter. Doesn't mean it's right. So subjectivity surely is not the test for truth. Secondly, Kierkegaard is a fideist. Now, you got to add new words to your category of understanding. Fideism is the position that there is no evidence that bears on one's faith, particularly in this context, is religious faith. You simply believe it. You can't prove it one way or another. There's no evidence for it. You just believe it. Simple believism, fideism. Now, unfortunately, a lot of evangelical Christians are fideists. I think that's unfortunate, and you'll see why. Either a fideist has a justification for his belief, or he doesn't. If he has a justification for it, he's not a fideist. If he doesn't, it's unjustified in believing it. So fideism either turns out to be self-defeating, for if you said to a fideist, why are you a fideist? And he wrote your book explaining why he's a fideist, he wouldn't be one, because he's giving you a reason why he's a fideist, and that's the one thing a fideist can't do, because he doesn't have any reasons why he believes. He just believes. Now, if he doesn't have any reasons, then his belief is unreasonable. Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. I agree. Apparently, Jesus did too. He commanded us to love the Lord with all our mind. Apparently, Peter did too. He commanded us to give a reason for the hope that is in us. God doesn't give you any brownie points for being stupid. Sometimes people will say, well, do you know anybody that was ever reasoned into the kingdom? Do you know anybody ever, you proved God to them that became a Christian? Well, first of all, the answer to that is yes, and I can give you a number of people, but my usual answer is this. Do you know anybody ever became a Christian because he thought it was irrational, stupid, and ignorant? And maybe reasons must have had some bearing then on why he became Christian. Fideism is self-defeating because it says, either I have a justification for my belief, in which case I don't simply believe it, I have a justification, or there is no justification for believing it, in which case it's unjustified belief. Third comment on Kierkegaard. Evidence is very important to belief. Evidence is very important to belief. Now, the truth of Kierkegaard is this, that as Christians, we must have a personal experience. We must have an encounter. There must be a subjective element to this. But there must also be an objective element, and that's the part that he neglected. And maybe I can best illustrate it the following way. What if I go home from here on Sunday afternoon, and I buzz into Mundelein where I live, and I buzz down Banbury Street and up the driveway, into the front door, into the arms of the waiting wife, give her a great big hug and kiss, and discover that I just kissed the neighbor lady. You say, something went wrong somewhere. You weren't looking at the evidence. They live on the left side. Theirs is 508. Yours is 506. She's short, skinny, blonde. Your wife is a little taller and is brunette. Your door is on the right. Her door is on the left. You missed a lot of evidence there before you made that existential commitment. Now, belief in God is the same way. What Kierkegaard confuses or doesn't even understand is this. There is a difference between belief that and belief in. Evidence bears on belief that. I have to have a lot of evidence that it's my house and that it's my wife before I'm going to hop in bed with her. Evidence bears on belief that. No evidence bears on belief in. Belief in is an act of the will. Belief in is subjective. For instance, you could have told me all of the things about my wife. Good looking, talented, good cook, all the objective things. That wouldn't make me want to love her or marry her. That's a subjective decision. But I would have to know that she was there before I'm going to march down the aisle and say I do to her, because I'm certainly not going to say that to a little heir standing there in front of the congregation. And I'm not going to go home and throw my arms around the heir and hug and kiss it. Or to make the illustration a little more radical, what if my wife dies this week? And all next week I buzz in the driveway, up, and I look at all the road signs, and that's my house, that's 506, that's my door, and I go in the front door, and I throw my arm around a wife who isn't there, and hug her and kiss her and talk to her. I say, something's wrong with this guy. It's an insane belief in. That's an insane commitment. Why? Because I don't have any belief that to support my belief in. Christians must have evidence that God is there before they believe in him. Now, belief that will never save you. Got to have the subjective. That part Kierkegaard was right about. It's only belief in that saves. Belief that Christ is the Son of God won't get you to heaven. The devil believes that, and he trembles. Belief in is necessary. But to neglect the evidence for that and to stress only the belief in is certainly contrary to Christianity. Next criticism. God can be known by reason. To say that God is unknowable is itself a knowledgeable statement about God, or it tells you nothing. To say, I know you can't know God, is to just adopt Kant in Kierkegaardian form. And so that's where his agnosticism comes out, and it has the same problem as it does in Kant. Now, the last critique is this. The principle of analogy can be stated this way. Every effect resembles its efficient primary cause. Every effect resembles its efficient primary cause. Now, I'll explain what efficient and primary mean. I think you know what an effect and a cause, what they are. Every effect resembles its efficient primary cause. A garage. There are six causes of a garage. And if you understand these six causes, then we can apply it back to this. One, there is the material cause of a garage. That's the wood, the nails, and all of that. That's the material. That's that out of which you make the garage. So the material cause of a garage is the stuff. There's the formal cause of a garage. That's the structure that holds the garage together. It's form, the way you formed it. So a garage has a material cause, the stuff, has a formal cause, the structure, that out of which and that of which. A garage also has what is called a instrumental cause, the instruments used to put it up, hammer, saw. Instrumental cause. A garage also has an exemplar cause. The word example comes from the exemplar cause, the blueprint, that after which the garage is patterned. And a garage also has a final cause, purpose, that for which the garage is put up, to park a car in. Well, not mine, junk and bicycles, but most garages. So you have the formal cause, that of which, the material cause, that out of which, you have the final cause, that for which, the purpose, you have the instrumental cause, that through which, but none of those will put a garage up. Blueprints don't put garages up. Hammers, you could pile hammers on the wood from here to the moon, and the garage wouldn't be put up. Formal causes don't put garages up. Material cause doesn't put garage up. You can pile the lumber there. There's only one thing that puts a garage up, an efficient cause. The carpenter, that by which the garage is put up. Now, having distinguished all of those causes, let me say why we use the words primary efficient cause in the definition. Well, every effect has to have an efficient cause because formal, material, final won't put it up. That's back to the garage. You have to have a carpenter, that by which. So we know why an effect has to have an efficient cause. Why is it that it can't be a secondary or instrumental cause? Because hammers in themselves don't put garages up, nor do saws, only in the hands of carpenters does that occur. So the garage does not look like the saw or the hammer, or it need not. It could. You could have a hammer the shape of a garage, but that'd be an accidental relationship there. Garages need not look like hammers, but garages must look like the blueprint in the mind of the carpenter. Because if they don't, then it's not the effect of that carpenter's mind. Likewise, when the creator creates creation, it must bear some resemblance to the creator. For instance, if you're taking an exam, the exam doesn't need to look like your fountain pen. You could have the whole exam written on your fountain pen. But that, again, would be not only cheating, but an accidental relationship there. Pens don't have to look like exams, but the exam must resemble your mind. There's got to be a resemblance between the effect and the cause. The only way to avoid Kantian agnosticism and Kierkegaardian existentialism, which says God is totally other, can't know anything about him, is analogy. the effect must resemble the cause, and those characteristics that we find in the effect can be appropriately attributed to the cause. Why? Because you can't give any perfection you haven't got. Bad English, but good philosophy. You can't give what you haven't got. If the effect got the positive characteristics, not negative or conditions, because God can't give the God doesn't have the condition of finitude, though he creates finite beings. But every positive characteristic that is found in the effect must be attributed to the cause without limitation, because he's unlimited. So if you find goodness in man, if man is goodness, God must be goodness, because you can't have something that you aren't participating in that which is it. And if man has goodness, God is good. If man has knowledge, God is knowledge. If man has truth, God is truth. The effect must bear some resemblance to the cause, but it must be different. Why? Because I am finite goodness. I have finite knowledge, and he is infinite goodness and infinite knowledge. Therefore, analogy. Analogy means the same, but different. Similar. Now let me say that one other way. The reason that our knowledge of God must be analogous is that it cannot be equivocal or univocal. And analogous is the only alternative. Equivocal means this. Totally different. The word bark, as applied to a tree and a dog, have equivocal meanings. The coating of a tree and the noise of a dog are totally different. Univocal means entirely the same. Good humanness in John and humanness in George, entirely the same meaning. George doesn't have humanness any more than John. That's univocal. Analogical means similar. Now, when I say George is good and God is good, that's not univocal. For if it were, George would be infinite goodness or God would be finite goodness. But they're not. Or I could worship George because he has intrinsic ultimate good. I can worship God because he has intrinsic ultimate good, but I can't do that to George. There's a difference. Analogy means partly the same and partly different. George has goodness. We mean the same thing by the definition, but the application is different. I understand goodness and define it the same way, but I apply it in a different way because George is finite and God is infinite. How do I know that? You can't give what you haven't got in terms of positive perfections. One. Two, if our language, like good and truth, were applied only equivocally to God, then God is totally different from that. I don't have the foggiest idea what he is. Agnosticism. But agnosticism is self-defeating. I can know something about God, therefore my knowledge could not be equivocal, because equivocal knowledge would be no knowledge at all. On the other hand, neither can it be univocal. For if I knew something about God in the same sense that I knew it about a finite creature, then either God would be finite or the creature would be infinite, because I'm applying it in the same way. I would be deifying the creature or finitizing God. Both are wrong. There is a real difference between a finite and infinite. Therefore, our language must be analogous. Add to the unnegotiables the principle of analogy. Every effect must resemble its primary efficient cause. That's why when we open the Bible and we see the effect words that God has written, those words really tell us something about the cause. Just like the exam really tells us something about the mind of the student. And if they don't, then all this is God talk, but it's not talk about God, which leaves us in skepticism. And when I look at creation, and I see the effects of the Creator, and it doesn't tell me anything about God, then I know nothing about God from creation. Analogy is the only answer to skepticism and agnosticism about God, whether it's revelational in terms of God's special revelation, or whether it's rational in terms of God's general revelation. The effect resembles the cause. Kant and Kierkegaard, agnosticism and existentialism. Underneath, imbibed in, worked out into the linguistics, the philosophy, the culture of our day, and without an answer to them, we have no way that we can defend a revelation that is meaningfully descriptive of the God who is there. Okay, I'll stop there and give you a chance to was fun. Okay. Start back there. Gentleman right here. Yes, notice I said that every positive... how do I interpret the problem of evil in the light of my problem, my principle of analogy? Because wouldn't it seem like evil is a characteristic of the world? Why not attribute evil to God? Evil is not a perfection. It's an imperfection. You only attribute perfections to the cause. It is not perfect. So evil is an imperfection, and you don't attribute imperfections. You only attribute positive characteristics, positive perfections to the Creator, because those He gave. Evil is a lack of those. It is a privation. Augustine, in his Anti-Manichaean writings, is the best source to read there. He came out of this dualism of there's eternal good stuff and evil stuff. And he said there is no stuffness to evil. Evil is an ontological parasite. It exists only in something else as a corruption of it. For instance, you never walk through the woods and run into pure rottenness. You might run into a rotten tree, but you never run into pure rottenness. Or you never go out into a parking lot and say, there is pure rustness. You might find a rusty car, but rust exists only in something else that is good as a corruption of it. Evil is an ontological parasite. That is an imperfection. It's a lack in something that should be there, but it's not a positive characteristic metaphysically. Now, that's not the same as saying evil isn't real. That's not the Christian Science who said that though pain is not real, yet when I sit upon a pin that punctuates my skin, I dislike what I fancy I feel. And that's not that at all. What it is, we are not saying evil is an illusion. We are saying evil is a real privation. Cut off your right arm. You're privated of a right arm. Is that real? Well, just tie up your right arm for a week or two and see if it's not a real lack. Or close your eyes and walk around for a week and see if blindness is not a real lack. So we're saying evil is real, but it's a real lack, a real imperfection in what God had created. I'm certainly saying God did not create metaphysical evil, yes. God is the source of all things, either directly or indirectly. He's the source of good directly and the source of evil indirectly by way of free will. God created a good thing called freedom, and that good thing brought evil into the universe. God created the fact of freedom. The acts of freedom are performed by the individual who does them. If it happens to be an evil act, then an evil act is attributable to that agent, but not to God directly, except indirectly by way of the fact He made evil possible. But to create the possibility of evil is not to create the actuality of it. The evil creature actualizes it.